Right, we're going to go ahead and start with a meditation, and that will give people time to come on in. But before I do, how many people, this is your first time here? Wow. Hello, welcome. How many of you, is this your first time to a Buddhist center? Okay. How many of you have ever meditated before? Oh, okay. I'll do just a very brief review for new people, and then we'll start talking about some of the other things. In this... Shout. Do I need a new battery? I didn't put a battery in.
I did.
Volunteers here. See, now I'm going to shout, and then I'm going to be quiet, and then I'm going to shout, and then I'm going to be quiet. You'll have audio vertigo. Are we switching?
Yeah.
Let's okay. But these work really well, so it's better if you can hear me, and it's better if I don't have to shout. Thank you, Chris. Okay, I need this meditation just probably as much, if not more, than all of you right now, because I barely made it in the door here 15 minutes ago with all the traffic and everything, and I've been traveling, so I wasn't actually at class last week, so we'll talk about that too. But for now, let's just kind of focus in. Take a breath and bring ourselves present in this tradition. Okay, there's many different types of meditation, and we've talked about the different types here, and we've tried to do several different types of meditation here. In our tradition, meditation comes in two forms, concentration and analytical, because we're really through Buddhism, especially in this Galupa tradition that we are in, we're working on our minds. So the meditation is allowing us to use our mind and learn to use our mind a little bit better. So the concentration meditations that we do with the breathing meditations and some of those simpler ones, object meditations, allow us to start to gain a little bit of mastery and a little control. It's a little bit like harnessing an elephant, tying him up to a post. We're using our mind, we're using concentration meditation to learn how to harness that power of the mind, or if you think of your mind like a little bit of a monkey mind that goes all over the place, we're using concentration meditation as a way to kind of pull that in so that we can focus a little bit better. So we focus with concentration meditation, and then analytical meditation, which is the equanimity meditation I believe you did last time. I think we've done that one. We'll do that again now. That's a little bit more thinking about something. That's working through a process. So you're not concentrating on something. You're actually going to walk through either a problem or something. You're going to actually work out some kind of solution or problem or something that's bothering you, or focus on some beautiful thing that you want to do more of in your life. So anything from compassion or anger or love or equanimity, which is a good one. That's about equalizing your feelings for different beings and people. So we're going to do what's called an analytical meditation. We have a posture that we use, a sitting posture that we use, and this actually comes, there's nothing holy about it, there's nothing holy about sitting at that mat, nothing holy about sitting on a chair, laying on a bed, meditating. This is all a process, and to get yourself in a position that can be held for a long period of time so that you can think about what you can meditate without worrying about what your body's doing. So it's a very practical way of thinking. So the 7-point meditation posture, is if you're sitting on the ground, you can sit in the Vajra position or just cross your legs, but you get a very solid base. So if you're sitting in a chair, lean a little bit forward from the chair. Keep your feet flat on the ground. So you concentrate on the base. Give yourself a solid base that is going to be able to be held and be comfortable. Then you're going to have your back is going to be straight, not very stiff, but very straight, kind of like your spine is a stack of coins. And you bring your shoulders back a little bit, kind of that regal position, and that opens your lungs a little bit so that you can breathe better. Your arms are kind of akimbo. That's always such a funny word to me, but that's what they've written. And your right hand goes on your left in the palm, and we touch our thumbs, and we place that at the base, like the your thumbs are like right underneath your belly button type of thing. So you're down at the bottom. Your arms are out a little bit, and again, that allows the airflow to go around your body and under your arms. Your head is tilted a little bit forward, and your eyes are slightly closed. Slightly open, slightly closed. Why is this? Because if you're totally closed and down, you will tend to be drowsy and fall asleep. If your eyes are open and your head is up, you could be too distracted by what's around you. Again, everything is a very practical reason for it. Your mouth, right? Your tongue is, your jaw is relaxed. Your teeth can be slightly apart. Your tongue is on the top of your palate just behind your front teeth. Why? Because it helps for saliva. Again, the very practical reasons about trying to get your body in a position that you can kind of let go of it while you work on your meditation. Okay, I want to take a couple of deep breaths, and then I'm going to read this. We're going to do the equanimity meditation that you went through last week with Karen. This meditation, we'll talk about it afterwards. This is really one of my favorites. And if you really think about this and you work with this a little bit, you find that it actually can make a difference in your everyday life. And I'll give you direct examples of how that can be. So the first thing, focus your attention on your breath. Use one of the various breathing meditations, whether it's counting the breaths or just the bare awareness, mindfulness, any of those things that we've done in this class to just settle your mind. Come into the moment, be present in a more concentrated state. I'm going to leave you just for a minute to just breathe. Okay, we're sitting in our comfortable positions, our seven-point meditation posture, and we're going to generate a motivation. Our intention for this meditation is to work on overcoming our self-centered bias and judgments and to develop the mind of perfect equanimity and balance toward others. Imagine in the space in front of you three people, someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone that you feel indifferent toward. And keep these three images in your mind throughout this meditation. First, focus on your friend. Allow your feelings for that person to arise strongly. Feel your conviction that this person is definitely and truly a friend, someone who's good to you and fulfills your needs and wishes, and feel how you really want this person to be happy and identify yourself with these good feelings that you have toward this person. Now shift your attention to your enemy, the person that you don't like. This person who's not kind to you, who's hurt you, who does not satisfy your needs, who annoys you and makes you angry. Regard this person carefully and look at those feelings that you have about this person. F- finally shift your attention to the so-called stranger, this person that you really don't know very well. So you don't really like them or dislike them, you just know them. You've seen them around. And look carefully at that person and note how that you really do feel, you know, indifferent. You don't have any strong feelings one way or the other. Now consider and recognize that the nature of your relationships with each of these three people and the labels that you've put on each of them, how they're based solely on what they do or don't do for you at this point in time. Think of people who have been your friend but then became your enemy and vice versa. Think of strangers who have become friends or enemies. Each of these labels is truly temporary and impermanent. It's just what the situation is at this current time. Now move your attention back to your friend and imagine a situation that might cause the friendship to end. Imagine your friend turning against you and experience the resentment and anger and hurt that you would feel if that happened. Do you still feel warm and friendly feelings toward that person? Do you still wish him or her well and want that person to be happy? So where is your friend now? And remember that this person was not your friend before you were acquainted. Recognize how easily this person can cease to be your friend now, just if you just have imagined. And think to yourself that there's no sound reason for feeling kind and loving toward only the friend of this moment. Relationships have changed in the past and will continue to change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy. Now move your attention to the present enemy and imagine a situation in which you could be drawn together and become close, a common interest, a word of praise or kindness. Look at that person and your feelings toward them very carefully. If you think about that, would your feelings soften a bit, become warmer? You can learn to feel warmly towards your enemies. This has happened before and it will happen again. And why do we hold so strongly to the concept that this person is definitely enemy? Now move your attention to the stranger and imagine how one act of kindness or anger from this person could immediately turn him or her into a friend or an enemy, respectively. There is no inherent, definite stranger there. There is no sound reason for the feelings of indifference that we hold on to. Remember that your present friend and your present enemy were both strangers to you before. And this enemy could become a friend or an enemy now. Maintain your awareness of these three people in front of you and think about the fragile impermanence of these relationships. It is only your misconceived belief in the concreteness of these labels of friend, enemy, and stranger that holds your mind back from the possibility of change and fluidity. Your friend, enemy, and stranger all want happiness just as much as you do. In this respect, we are all equal. Also, everyone is equal in having the potential to develop their minds to the fullest extent and to achieve ultimate clarity and compassion. The differences that we see in people are superficial and based only on our mistaken and narrow self-centered views. In fact, everyone is equal in deserving our care and compassion. And none of this means that we should not discriminate at all on a practical level. Our ability to distinguish between actions and individuals is very necessary. And naturally, we'll feel closer to some people and are wise to keep our distance from others. This is not in any way contradictory to the meditation above. The point of the meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, for their well-being, whether they help or harm us at this point in time, and to see that the labels that we put on others are often arbitrary, mistaken, and very changeable. And finally, dedicate all of this positive energy and insights that you've had to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. Oh, I feel a little better. Even though I just meditated, I was running so much when I got here. Did you guys do the meditation, this equanimity, last week with Karen? Yeah? How did you like Karen? She's really good, isn't she? It's always good, I think, to have the opportunity to learn from different people, because we all will present something differently or say something differently. And with Karen, she just kind of has that calm thing for me. I've taken some of her classes, and she also does a lot of this in her business life, too. So I just really enjoy learning from her. I tend to be a little bit more gregarious and up and down. But now, how many people, how many new people here? Wow, okay. So, good evening. It is September 30th, and we are in session 5 of a 5-week course. Now, that does not mean that you're going to be blown out of the water and not know what we're talking about, because this is Buddhism in a nutshell. It's a very, very basic plan. We are going to try to continue the talk, so we can kind of stay in line with some things, but we'll do a little bit of review from last week, so I can kind of gauge where you are. And I think one of the questions that I wanted to ask, the last class, there's always a little bit of an exercise that we do about thinking that you're going to die tomorrow. Did you guys do that? Did you do that? How many actually did it? How many did the exercise? So how'd that work for you? The exercise was that tomorrow morning, you guys who are here tonight for the first time, you try this tomorrow, okay? Tomorrow morning, I want you to wake up, and the first thought that you have, the very first thought, as soon as you can, I want you to think, I'm going to die today at 6 p.m. I only have until 6 p.m. today. And I want you to pay attention to how that day goes for you and how your mind goes and what you might do differently in your life if you had that realization. Now, we still have to go to work. You still have to pay the bills. You cannot just up and check everything and head off to the beach and charge up your credit cards, okay? We have to live life. But it's just a practice that if this is the only day that you had left, what would you do with it? And just be aware. It's amazing what that will do. That's the exercise. And that's actually not the exercise. That's the reality that many people who have been diagnosed with cancer, many people who have been diagnosed with these diseases or know things, that is a actually beautiful gift that they're given, because they change their lives, okay? And it would be nice to be able to give that gift to all of you without having to go through that, all right? If you have that opportunity to, how are you going to live your life? Do we have the mic? One of these, Chris? You bought new toys. Okay. I leave for a week and look at what happens. Okay. How did that work for you?
It was very odd, I will admit. At first I thought it was depressing to think about, you know, on a beautiful day to wake up and it would be the end of my life and, you know, 12 hours, 10 hours, or whatever. I did notice that it changed my attitude during the day. I had to constantly remind myself. It was just so easy to, like, okay, you wake up that thought, and then I
yeah, go have your coffee, and I got to go to work, and what's my shopping today, and go to the grocery store. Well, that's right. I'm dying today.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that. I'm dying today.
But it's changed a little bit. You were a little nicer, maybe, to the people around you?
Yeah, and
to myself
as well.
Yeah, hello.
But
Imagine that.
I will admit that I was a little bit tempted, like, if this was really the case. I mean, would I go to the beach?
Yeah, we can't do that. We're not going there.
I was tempted.
Yeah, because we have to, again, we have to live life. So there's a part of this, and part of what we are doing is we're finding tools and stuff to live a happier life, and we're working on these things. So we have to learn how to get through. I'd love to just go live at the beach. I'd love to, you know, just win the lottery and go sit on the beach, and that's all I have to do. But would I be happy? Maybe for a week, maybe even 2 weeks. And then I don't think I could do that. But that's part of the practice. We're all different. But how do you get through everyday life? How do you get through the things that we have to deal with in everyday life? And how do you, why do you make the choices that you make to live the way you do, to do the things you do, and the different actions that we take? So this is just part of, it's part of this whole big practice. Anybody else do it? Anybody else have any other? Like I said, for those of you that are new, give it a shot. So tomorrow morning, wake up in the morning, and as soon as you can, think, wow, I'm dying today. And it, see what happens. See where your mind goes.
There were so many lists I'd have to make.
Oh, I make lists for my lists. Yeah, those bucket lists. So you can take it to where you think all the big things, the going to the beach, the telling your family you love them, making sure you talk to everybody that you care about. So there's those big things. Wouldn't it be nice if we actually did those big things a little more often? Wouldn't it be nice if we told our children or our parents or our brother or sister that we love them a little bit more often? Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't it be, you know, the big things and don't wait? One of the things that we work on is this. This is what you talked about last week, that precious human rebirth, that life is so uncertain. Life is so uncertain. Okay, we can easily look in here and say, you know, I'm 50-something years old. I'm 54 years old. Okay, who's the youngest? You look fairly young. How old are you? 19. Okay, that's young. The honest expectancy in this room would be that she's going to live a lot longer than I am, isn't it? Because that's just the way we tend to think. I'm old. She's, you know, 30 years younger. Something could happen. She could have a car accident tomorrow. Something could happen. We cannot just rely on what we think is going to happen just because it kind of tends to go that way. All of us, something could happen as we leave here tonight. Something could happen right here with a heart attack or something. We don't know. Life is impermanent. But we all go through it like it's not, don't we? We all just kind of live our lives like it's just going to go on forever. We do, especially in this civilization, especially in the Western world. We don't want to talk about death. In fact, we fight it every step of the way, and we can do everything to look young. We don't ever talk about death in the Western society, very, very rarely. And when we do, it's very depressing. But if you actually start studying some of it and you start thinking about it and using it a little bit more, it's actually not depressing, and it creates a vibrancy and a joy. For me, it has been one of those awakenings for me that I go through my life a lot differently now that I think about it. My life is much more precious, and it's much fuller, and I enjoy it a lot more because I think about it. Because I think, boy, what if it was today? When's the last time I talked to my sister? Last week, when I talked to her, did we just talk about stuff, or did I actually tell her that I really care for her, that she has been a very important part of my life? It's not so hard to say, you know. So it's just these things. It's just, it brings your life much more fuller. So this precious human rebirth that we're talking about, for here, we're talking about from a Buddhist perspective, the precious human rebirth is the fact that we have been born as humans. And actually, for us, we're sitting here in Kadampa Center. We are not in a war-torn country. We are not over in Syria. We are not over in Tibet. We are not over in any other country where we can't actually be sitting here and studying a topic of our choice. We've got air conditioning. We've got clean water. Okay, so we have been given this precious human rebirth from a Buddhist perspective, that we have this opportunity. There's a lot of people that they, you know, everybody thinks, well, but just being born human is awesome. Well, sure it is, but not everybody that is born a human has the same opportunities that we do. Okay, and not everybody is reborn as human. So I'm not quite sure how deep I want to go on what Karen talked about last week, because I could start that whole class all over again, and we will never get through what we need to tonight. So I need to be real careful about that. But this is where we're kind of talking about that Buddhist view of death. I had the opportunity to talk a little bit with Robert Thurman, Bob. It seems so funny to say, but it was awesome. And it was fun to kind of have some of my concepts and my thoughts, you know, and the things that I've been learning and talked about and revalidated from him. Because from a Buddhist perspective, the view of death is not this negative, you know, scary, awful things, because we actually pull it out and we look at it. We actually have a death meditation. Because what is fear? Fear is usually fear of the unknown, isn't it? It's usually fear of the unknown. So if you actually pull it out and look at it and deal with it, and go through the steps and think about it, you're not going to be as afraid of it when it starts to happen. Because you know what? It's going to. I'm sorry to say, there's not a single one of us that's going to get out of here alive. Okay? So we might as well look at it so that we're not afraid of it. And then once you break through that other side, it really does become more about joy than about depression. So the Buddhist view of death is really not this negative, scary thing. And we're also looking at our lives. We've talked about that continuity of mind. Okay, I actually look at my life because I've had a pretty wonderful life. You know, I've had ups and downs. I've dealt with a lot of bad things, but I've also had a pretty wonderful life. I've got a phenomenal family. You know, I love what I do for a living. I'm here. I'm working on all this. So I kind of tend to think that I've got it pretty good. Well, I've got it pretty good because whoever was the caretaker of my mind before obviously did a lot of good things to set me up so well. And so I tend to look at it like I am the caretaker of this mind and trying to set that next person up. It's the same way we think about ecology and the planet, take care of it for our kids. I look at that as my mind like that as well. So I want to take care of this mind, and I want to set this mind and that next, I'd love to reach enlightenment this lifetime. Believe me, I'm working on it. But I'm also a realist, okay? And I'm not able to study for as much as I would like to. But so I'm just trying to do the best I can to try to set the next caretaker of this mind up in the best way possible. I'm trying to do the studying. I'm trying to create as much wonderful merit and be as kind and compassionate. So I'm working on it. I actually have things I do that I try to think about this way because there's that next continuity of mind. And so I don't have this Western view of that's it, okay, or that unknown that we tend to have in the Westerns. You know, well, I shouldn't say that in the West. There's a lot of I think countries and cultures and stuff that it's not quite as spelled out as I think many of us would like. With the studying that I've done, it's pretty spelled out. I think that it's pretty spelled out for me. There's quite a logical path that I can do. So it's not quite the unknown, so therefore I'm not as afraid of it. Okay? So she talked about the three scopes. Middle, like I said, I'm going to wing through this stuff. The lower, middle, and greater scope, because I want to make sure that we've got time to get to some of the other concepts. The lower scope, this is where we're focused on a fortunate rebirth. You're going to focus on the next life. Middle scope, you're going to focus on liberation from suffering, the freedom from cyclic existence. Is this all kind of familiar? I'm going to get to the stuff that where we're going to start talking pretty soon. And the greater scope is really focusing on full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So it's not just us. This is that bodhicitta that we've been talking about. If you remember, I didn't write it up on the board because I ran out of time, but the Four Noble Truths that we were talking about, okay, to go through all of those things. And that last line on there was what is the path? And it was the bodhicitta, renunciation, and the wisdom of emptiness. Right? No? You didn't get that? Yeah, okay. Okay, so you talked about renunciation, and now everybody knows that they don't have to go out and give everything up, right? Everybody understood that part? It is not about giving everything away? Keep your stuff. It's okay. Just lose the attachment. Okay? Lose that feeling that you are going to be really unhappy when your car gets, you know, crunched. That you, you know, you get that, well, my car didn't get crunched, but I lost battery, so I was dealing with a bad car, so all of my analogies are going to automobiles right now. But it's not about giving everything up. You don't have to give everything up. Renunciation is an internal process, and it's more about just taking care that the attachment and aversion, okay, those things that we kind of talked about in that meditation, that attachment, those things that we become and put a little bit more emphasis on and exaggerate the good qualities or exaggerate the bad qualities. We put our own little levels of layering onto this thing. But it's an internal process, giving up attachment. Okay, and attachment and aversion really both, giving up both of those. Okay, bodhicitta. This is a great word. It is a mind, a consciousness that combines the two factors of wishing to free all beings from suffering and of wishing to attain enlightenment because of that. Aspirational bodhicitta, engaging bodhicitta, these are some of the terms that you hear. So basically, I want everybody to be free of suffering. And guess what? I'm going to work so that I can help that. Okay? This is not just reaching nirvana for myself. Okay? I want to reach it. I want to learn all these things so I can help. And it's taking the responsibility of doing that. That's what bodhicitta is. Yes? Oops. Thank you, Chris.
A lot of additional reading on the topic as well. And where I struggle on renunciation and attachment is in the context of love.
And so we're not supposed to focus and we're not supposed to become so attached. And the pathway to enlightenment is through this. But in my specific example, I have two daughters. And there's absolutely no way in the world I could do that.
Okay, that is a phenomenal question. That's really good. I love the concept of that. Okay, so, because I have this one a lot, and let me work through it kind of my way. We're not talking about loving your daughters less at all, ever. We're not talking about loving your husbands and your wives or anybody less, ever. Okay? Because we do. We love our children. I've got four of them. And absolutely. Actually, the reason I can kind of go along with this is because I remember thinking some of that way. You know? My husband, he was not liking this whole idea at all. And what does that mean? So we're not talking about loving anybody less. But we're talking about working to make it a bit more of a pure love. Okay? So, I'm going to work on a good analogy here. I'm going to leave children aside for just a second because that is a little bit of a special thing there, okay? You want your kids to be happy no matter what. You truly have that compassionate love with them because you don't want your children to suffer ever, correct? Ever. If I could wrap those kids up in cotton wool and stick them over in a closet so they could never get hurt, man, I would do it, okay? But a lot of the stuff that I want to do for my kids is probably not what's best for them because we have to let them go through these things to grow. Okay? So that attachment of that love that I want to do it because it's really about me, because I don't want to watch them go through that, that's attachment. That pure love of we know, that wisdom and compassion, okay, that we know, you know what, it's going to hurt. I know it's going to hurt. Oh, man, I got one that's going to be hurting pretty soon. Girlfriend, boyfriend stuff. And it's like, but I got one over here that's getting married. It's like, okay. So, but it's trying to let them go through these things. That's that wisdom and the purity of the love that you know that that's going to be hard for them, right? And you know it's going to be hard for you to watch that. But if you stepped in to stop it, that's attachment because then it's about you, not about them, correct? That's what we're talking about. And if you could take that pure love that you have for that child, okay, and if you could feel that same love for everybody in this room, What would that mean? How would that feel? You see what I'm saying? Take that same pure love. This is that equanimity. If you take that equanimity meditation that we do, I see a white screen. Okay, I work in visuals. I see this white screen, and I see my husband come walking out. He's the one I love. Okay, so he stands there. I even got his mannerisms down. What I'm doing here. Then I'll have, usually it's the lady from the post office, or there's a lady at Target. You know, you tend to go at the same times, and she's the stranger. You know, I don't really know her, but she's nice enough, so I don't, you know. It's a little bit not indifferent, but that's that person. And then I've had a couple of times where in my business world, okay, I've got a vendor that has just torqued me off. You know, I'm really not happy with what they did, how they did it. So I bring them out because I don't really hate anybody, but, you know, people can, you know, frustrate you. So this one time a long time ago, I had a web vendor that just had made me very frustrated. I actually said I wasn't ever going to work with him again. All of a sudden, I'm working with a new client, and they say, I have to work with this web vendor. I have to. I have no choice. I do not like this man. He mucked up. He messed up. He did all this stuff. I was really not happy about that. I actually thought about letting the whole job go. I thought, okay, I'm going to do this meditation. I'm going to sit down. So I did. So I out walked my husband on this white screen. Out walked my little post office lady. And in walked this guy, this vendor. And I've got them in my mind on this meditation. And I feel all of this love for my husband. And it's not like I'm trying to take it away, because me, love is not finite. Okay, so I'm trying to get this love, of it. I'm trying to equalize. Okay, and all, I'm gonna call him Bill. All Bill wants is to be happy. He didn't do anything maliciously. He just did something that, you know, he needed to do for his business. I started thinking, man, he probably has 3 kids. He's trying to do all this stuff. Maybe he had a bad day. So I went through all this stuff to, you know, kind of cut him some slack. I started feeling all the love that I feel for my husband and just get that emotion in there. And then I started thinking about Bill probably has that for his family, his wife, his kids. I don't even know if he's married. I don't know. But you make up the stories. And all of a sudden I thought, you know what? Yeah, I can give him another shot. And I actually picked up the phone and I called him about 5 minutes after I got done with that meditation. And I started the conversation, and I opened the door, and I said, we're going to be working together again on this client. And we started talking, and you know what? It went phenomenally well. He didn't change at all. I changed. I'm the one that changed. My tone of voice was different, I'm sure. Everything. I changed. He didn't change, and all of a sudden that door was opened, and that's how the equanimity actually works in my everyday life. But to take that purity of love that you have for your children and try to imagine that love and try to use that love and share that. We're not saying to love them less, but to try to see where you might have some attachment in there. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Help a little?
Just
work on it. Just work with it. Yeah. Doesn't mean to love them less. Doesn't mean for me to love my husband less. Does not mean that I should try to do this stuff. It is a practice. None of the concepts that we are talking about in here are things that you're going to walk out the door and you're going to know. I'm trying to just open a little crack and shed a little light and maybe show an interest that you will continue to work on some of these concepts and see where they can go if you find them a benefit and try to take it further. None of the things that we're talking about here are things that you're going to go and say, wow, Sandy explained that so well, I get it. New. All right. But check into it a little bit further. There's so many other teachers and so many other books and so many other things, so that it'll come at you from this way, it'll come at you from this way. You know, some teacher will come and explain that very same concept to you, and all of a sudden, oh, there, I get that. I can understand that.
It's a pretty common question that comes up.
All the time. Yeah.
Because when I researched it, Google search.
Yep.
Yeah, boom.
And yeah.
About 10,000 people with the same question.
Yeah, and you'll have them. The Dalai Lama in The Art of Happiness touches on, read that whole book, phenomenal book, one of my favorites, because I think he touches on that a little bit. Amy Miller has touched on that a little bit. There's some of that will be in her Buddhism in a Nutshell book. I think there might be some little flavors on that. Geshe-la, our teacher, Geshe Gelug Choda, actually talks about that a lot, and he talks about it from the perspective of Mother Teresa and her infinite love for the children that she cared for and how. So it's kind of that, so two concepts to work on with that question. These are, again, because I have that same one, and one of them is infinite love, okay, that love is not this finite thing that you have to only parcel out so much of it, okay? It's really immeasurable and infinite, okay? That changes, but once you start thinking about this, that kind of changes and allows it to open up a little bit. And the other is the pure purity of love. So to try to do that just for them. Okay, I've got another good example, that same type of concept, okay? Husbands and wives, love, okay? Pure love, the whole thing, right? Anybody divorced in here? Okay, I'm on my number two. All right, that, so you take that and all of a sudden it changes. So how can you take this person that you loved, married, and now all of a sudden, not, and how that can change. So it's really interesting to see how, think about that love, and if I truly had loved that person, if I truly had loved my first husband the way that I think now, okay, I probably would have still divorced, but I wouldn't have gone through the mind problems that I did, because I would want him the best for him no matter what, whether it's good for me or not, right? So interesting concept to just work with, okay? Just keep working it. Keep Googling. Emma Chodron is really good. She would have some good stuff on that. Yeah, but it's just sit down and think about it and work with it. And rather than coming at it with, well, I'm not going, I can't do that, maybe open that door enough to say, okay, I don't think that's what they're, is that really what they're asking?
That was my question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my answer to that is no. So does that help? Elise, any other ideas or thoughts on that one? Okay. Okay. We're getting, oh boy. I can't believe this is the last class already. Chris, I swear next time I'll have a PowerPoint so we can use your screens. I think this thing's so many years old. Okay, so bodhicitta we talked about. That really unconditional love, and that you are going to take responsibility for it. Bodhicitta is a huge word in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. Okay? Bodhisattva means somebody that has the mind of a bodhicitta. Okay? I have a good story about this just from my perspective. You'll get a kick out of it. So a few years ago, I had taken all of these classes, right? And there's a whole class. We'll talk about it later. Discovering Buddhism is that 14, two-year course with 14 different modules. And one whole module is on bodhicitta. Okay, a whole 5-6 week module, you're talking about nothing but bodhicitta. So I take the class, and I was taking it for a certification so that I could leave classes and things, and I was the only one out of this whole class that was doing that, so I've got a little bit of stuffy pride there. Ooh, I must be good, because I'm the only one taking it for the test. I aced the test, right? 100%, got all the questions right. I was feeling pretty good. So I go home that night after class, and I'm just feeling all proud of how well I've done, and I have such a bodhicitta mind. And I was doing this thing with my husband, and I had to get this group of women together, a social event. I was trying to help with something. I had to get this group of women. Out of all these 10 women, only one RSVP'd, and it was the one that I didn't particularly care for. And I was not happy about that. And I was nee-nee-nee with my husband that I've got to sit and I've got to do this, and she's the only one, now I'm going to do this. You know what's going to happen. I could not believe. All of a sudden I was just like, oh, Miss Bodhicitta. I was horrified. I started crying. I was so upset. I started crying. I thought, oh my gosh, look at you. Look at you. I was terrible. Oh, I cried. I called my teacher. It was everything. I was so upset that my mind had just literally, from a half an hour of class, right down in that cycle of, that was the most ungenerous mind and the most unkind mind. Okay, so I cried and I cried and I cried, and I called my teacher, and she said, Sandy, get a grip. And she said, you have to stop looking at that, because that is the practice and you're discovering it sooner. This time you caught it within an hour. You know, last time maybe it would have taken you a week, 2 weeks, or a month before you'd have realized that you were being unkind and ungenerous in your mind. So my cycle is, I'm getting better. Okay? But that's my big joke now, so anything like that comes up, now I go, that's bodhicitta. Because it's just that cycle. I just went home for a wedding not too long ago, and I had a flash of anger over some little wedding thing. And I was walking, I said, step away. You know, and I'm walking away, and how many saw Men in Black? Okay, you know that bug guy? And I just, my mind was so torn because I was so torqued over here, and it was like, and I wanted to just continue that story. Do you know what they just did? And my other mind's going, look at you, what are you doing? Stop that, that's all. And I just could feel myself doing this, walk all the way, step away, stop talking about it, just let it go. But this is, we're working with our mind. This is the practice. So it's, but we're working with our mind while we're using our mind. It's just like with that car driving down the freeway and trying to be a mechanic on a car that's driving 60 miles down the highway. So we have to have, that's why I liked your statement about that you felt compassion for yourself, because it really actually has to start there, doesn't it? I'm still working on that one too. Okay? So this all kind of ties into that six perfections. I'm going to start bringing stuff back from the beginning class, okay? Remember when we talked about those positive and virtuous actions, and we were writing some of those on the board? And it said generosity and morality, patience, joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom. These are the six perfections that really encapsulated all those virtuous things that we talked about from day one. Okay, so this all starts to tie in together with some of the things that we're doing. It all comes down to this. It shouldn't be that hard. And it's not. It's not hard to talk about. It's not hard to really actually even understand. It's rather hard to continually practice and to stay in that mindset. So remember we did the definitions of compassion, the sincere wish that others be free from suffering and its causes. Love, the wish that others have happiness and its causes, no matter what, no matter who they are, no matter what they do to you, no matter what they do to you. If you can feel this for their side and not as to what it means to you and how nice they were to you, that's what equanimity is. The absence of the usual discrimination, everybody was teasing Karen about her misspelling, here's one of mine, discrimination of sentient beings into friend, enemy, and stranger, deriving from the realization that all beings are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. Since beginningless time, all beings have been all things to each other. And this is that basis for development of great love, great compassion. That's what bodhicitta is. Okay, yes, all this will be in that book. Should be, somewhere in there. Okay, now, we are going to kind of continue on. I want to do, where am I at? Boy, I'm going to swing through. Okay, on the website, when you go to the website, KadampaCenter.org website, and you go to Spiritual Programs, and then you go to Buddhism in a Nutshell, you find that class, you will find all these handouts. Okay, I think a lot of you already have. All of the meditations that we've been doing and some of the others have been up there. There's also handout number 6, which is the foundation of all good qualities. All right, I'm not going to go through all of this, but this is actually a prayer, and this is a very important Lam Rim prayer, and its meaning actually relates to the Lam Rim, the graduated path to enlightenment. This can actually be used as what we call a glance meditation, where you read it, and you think about what it's saying in here, and this will actually refer to a lot of the teachings. So you actually will think about it. And one of the things, I'm going to read one of the stanzas here. I'm not going to go through the whole thing because we really don't have time, but since some of you might be looking at it or have downloaded it, the first one, the first stanza, the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and venerable guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. All right, we're going to talk about the importance of the spiritual guide for just a few minutes. Again, in Discovering Buddhism, there's a 6-week course on just the spiritual guide. But I since this is such a new class, I think it's very important to cover this part. The word guru or lama, teacher, means heavy, heavy with knowledge of the Dharma, a spiritual guide or a teacher. All right, one who shows a disciple the path to liberation and enlightenment. We're in the West, and we hear guru, and we go, cult. All right? Big difference here. Okay, so let's do some definitions. Again, always bringing it back to definitions from a Buddhist perspective. Here in the West, we use the word teacher very loosely. All right, we have teachers. I think many of you sometimes have referred to me as a teacher, and I'm really not from a Buddhist perspective. I lead this class. But a teacher from a Buddhist perspective is one who really walks you down a specific path. They have specific qualities that they have to meet. I'll walk you through some of those. But there's a whole criteria from a Buddhist perspective for that word teacher. Okay, and that word teacher is a lot different than our Western word teacher. We have the fifth grade teachers, we've got the college teachers, we've got, you know, high school, college, elementary teachers, we've got teachers that are really coaches, we kind of use that, we've got mentoring things, we'll go watch some seminar and we call them a teacher. We use that as a very broad, somebody that we're going to learn from, but we don't really have a connection. We can go sit in that class, listen to that class, and walk out that class and think nothing more of them, correct? So it's a very different word to us. The teacher is a very loose word, and it just means somebody that you're going to learn something from, right? From a Buddhist perspective, a teacher has a responsibility. They have a responsibility to you, the student, and you, the student, have a responsibility to them, the teacher. A Buddhist perspective says that you should check that teacher out for maybe 10 to 12 years before you agree to take them as a teacher, before you say, I want to be your student. Before you would ever say that, you better check them out. Because once you say that, and if they take you, there's a responsibility on both sides there. Geshe Gelug Choda is our resident teacher here. When he's talking in class and in Sundays, he's very clear to say, I'm your Dharma friend. I am your, you know, he will differentiate from his view of what a teacher, okay? Now, there are several people here at the center that Geshe is their teacher, from a Buddhist perspective. But there are many people here that he's a Dharma friend, and they have that Western view. Okay? Two completely different things. Some of the criteria for a guru, for a true lama and a true teacher, they've got to have all of the different trainings. They must have mental quiescence in higher concentration, meaning they should have been able to attain calm abiding, a certain type of meditation. They have to have pacified all delusions and obstacles from that training. They have to have more knowledge than you. They have to have enthusiastic perseverance and joy in teaching and a treasury of scriptural knowledge, insight and understanding of emptiness. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Skill in presenting the teachings, great compassion, no reluctance to teach. There is a list of like the top 10, and then that list goes on. And if that person does not have at least 5 of these, can't be a teacher from a Buddhist perspective. So it's a totally different thing. And if you read about this and really check into this, then you don't ever have to worry about being part or even being thought of as being part of a cult. Nobody's drinking the Kool-Aid here. Okay? So there's a real differentiation, and if you guys get a chance to go take that class, The Spiritual Guide, you'll have a much more opportunity. But this is why we're very careful, and you probably have heard a lot of us talk that way. You know, we're leading the class or to go. There's a lot of very, very qualified teachers here, and we're very fortunate that we have them here. But from our perspective, think about it. Are you thinking about this as a Western teacher? Which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. but it's a little bit different than that guru devotion. So when you're looking at these things like the foundation of all good qualities, and if you're very new to this, and all of a sudden you think you're reading on this, and you're thinking, Jim Jones, all over the place, you know, that's not it. So it really differentiates. And any time a question like that comes up in your mind where you're wondering, what is that? Go to the definition. Go to the Buddhist definition of the word, because you have to remember that this is all being translated from like four different languages down to English. You know, they started, I can't even remember, Pali through Sanskrit through Tibetan through English, and the words mean, there's such a slight differentiation of the words, so make sure you've got the right definition. But it's just interesting to go through this. The second stanza talks about precious human rebirth. So some of this you'll be familiar with, and some of it will be coming up in other classes, but this is a very well-known prayer, and especially in our tradition. Okay, now we are going to get into, and I don't have a lot of time, which is always the case. Okay, the wisdom of emptiness, all right? Compassion and wisdom are the second and third of the three principal aspects of the path, somewhere on one of those, okay? Just like a bird needs two wings to fly, we both need compassion and wisdom to reach enlightenment. There's a lot of jokes that go around that to be a Buddhist, you can't just be nice. You have to be smart. You can't just be smart. You have to be nice. You can't just be one or the other. And actually, compassion and wisdom, it is the base of everything that we learn here. It's my tattoos, okay? And I try to keep my head right between those two, because you cannot just be compassionate and want to help everybody if you don't know how to do it. Then you're not helping, okay? You have to be able to swim before you can save somebody from drowning. You're not helping. And if you're so cold that you have this knowledge and you can't share it and you can't use it in a compassionate way, then that knowledge really is useless too. Okay, so you really need to have both. So everybody pretty much knows how to be nice, okay? And then we start talking about wisdom, and that kind of opens up the door to a lot of things. And we talk about emptiness, and a lot of people think about that as a very difficult topic. But like everything else that we've discussed, it's not easy to understand, but it's very interesting, and it's about just opening that door a little bit and being willing to listen, and think about it. Again, they have the emptiness. What we're going to talk about, emptiness, is something people study their whole life. And you're not going to get it in 15 minutes. So just kind of go with it. Let's hope that we can kind of open the door a little bit. I'm going to do a little bit of reading out of Venerable Amy's book, because it just is so much easier. And that gives us kind of a little bit of a basis. So what does the term emptiness mean? According to Tibetan Buddhism, emptiness refers to an absence of inherent existence. So we're going to go through some of these words. What is inherent existence? Inherent existence is a quality we instinctively project onto ourselves and everything we experience. We see things as solidly, concretely existing from their own side, in and of themselves, by way of their own nature, independent of causes and conditions, parts, or our own mind experiencing them. Okay, that, all of a sudden, we start getting into lots of words. So, we're going to do it standy style. A couple of rules about emptiness. Okay? I've got an apple, I've got some markers, I've got a Kleenex box, I've got some flowers. What else can I put in here? I'll put a meditation bell in here, and I'm going to put the mic in here. Okay, so I got lots of stuff in this box, don't I? I'm going to take the mic out. Is the box empty? Still a lot of stuff in there, isn't there? But I could say, we don't talk this way, but I could say that this box is empty of Mike, couldn't I? We just don't talk that way from a language, but this box is empty of Mike. There is no Mike. Empty of Mike. No Mike. Okay? We all understand what I'm saying, but there's stuff in here. So emptiness does not mean nothingness. I'm going to come at this from a million different ways tonight, and I just need you to get that in there right now. From a Buddhist perspective, emptiness does not mean nothingness. We are not going down nihilistic talk at all. It just means that it's empty of Mike. It's empty of this. It's empty of that. We just don't see things the way that they truly exist. Okay? Again, I'm just going to come at this from a few different ways, and we're going to do our best, and we have a time limit. Okay. What do I have here? Okay. Tell me when it stops being a flower. If you looked at this, when would somebody come in and say, oh, look at that flower? Right? Anytime now? Is that still a flower or is that just a whole bunch of parts? Okay, do you think anybody would walk in here and go, oh, look at that flower? Probably not too many, maybe some. Right? So we start putting labels on things. This is all about labels. We start putting labels on things, and we're doing that really for the most in order to communicate concepts. This flower to us is a flower. What is this to an ant?
That's right.
Okay. Does anybody know what a different language, the word flower? I can do some of these things from different things. Okay, we know this here in America as a flower. We know these as flowers because that's what we were taught as children. Okay. Now, but that's just a label, isn't it? And it's just a part. Okay? So what we're trying to get at a little bit here is that we mix the label up with the thing. Okay? This flower really doesn't exist from its own side. Okay? Everybody's starting to hear that. Exists from its own side. If this flower existed from its own side, I would never have been able to rip it up, would I? Because now it's parts. Things exist. Things exist from causes and conditions, from parts, and from a discriminating or labeling mind. That's how things actually exist. And we don't think about it like that. That's here's where we're going to get into the emptiness of things. We tend to think of things as existing from their own side. This permanent thing, this thing, you can go at it with people, okay? So Sandy, so you look here and you see Sandy, right? And you can start putting the labels on. Woman, white, American, North Carolinian, brunette, chubby, funny, dumb, you know, whatever your labels are. These are just labels. If I existed independently from my own side, you would all see the same Sandy. But if I had each of you given a piece of paper and you started writing down your labels for me, you would have different labels, wouldn't you? Somebody would see something a little bit different. Or somebody, my ex-husband, would write some fun labels, wouldn't he? Okay? So, but because everybody is putting their perceptions, you're wrapping all of this stuff up. But that's coming from your side. That's not from my side. Okay? So, again, I'm going to just kind of keep coming at this from different directions. And you guys can start throwing questions in as you will. We're just going to keep doing things. So parts, causes, and conditions, labeling mind, this is called dependent arising, okay? Dependent arising. And that is, I'll see. Okay, dependent arising. This is the way that things actually exist. The way that the self and phenomena exist conventionally is relative and interdependent. They come into existence in dependence upon causes, conditions, their parts, the mind labeling, imputing that. Everything. 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 Anybody disagree with me? Can anybody think of something that doesn't exist that way? So one of the things that we talk about is that we're talking about not only the human mind, we're talking about all sentient minds. So we're talking about animals, we're talking about bugs, we're talking about everything, even microbial things. Okay? So we talked about that the ant is going to see that as food. Okay? A bee would have seen it the first time as food. Somebody from another country would have called that something other than flour. We call it flour because we labeled it that so that we could communicate the concept. Okay? But anybody have the experience, again, this is about people and the way that we do things, okay, where you have this friend that you really like and you want to introduce that friend to another friend. And it's like, oh, have you ever met Bill? He is awesome. You'd really like him. And I think you should maybe go out with him because I think you guys would have a lot in common. And she goes, I met Bill. He's awful. I don't want to. He does this. He does that. But these are two friends that have just a different perspective on the same person. But we put those on there like that is who Bill is. Okay? You have your perception that you're putting on. So it's like we have this object and we put this wrapping paper, this label on top of it, and then all of a sudden it just gloms onto it. And we can't separate that out. Okay? We can't separate that. Does this make sense? Any questions? I feel like all I've been doing is talk. La, 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 la. Does this kind of make a little sense? Can anybody think of anything? You want to try it? You want to try it? Anything that doesn't exist this way, through dependent arising. You will hear, if you study Buddhism at all, anymore, you will hear this time and again, dependent arising. Everything is dependent on those three things to exist.
No.
Go ahead, Chris.
It's like the thing is the same, and there is something there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's totally dependent on what the observing mind sees.
You're at it.
Yeah.
It's
like, well, did I just say this?
Go for it.
We have a dinner party at our club, and this happens all the time. We'll make something, and everybody will eat from the same dish, and some people just really love this.
Mm-hmm.
And then one or two people, maybe, they'll go, oh, my gosh, I can't believe, you know, who let this person in the house with this bowl of crap? Yeah. And it's really obvious when you look at it, like, you know, in detail, but it's real hard to lose that. Like, then right away, you'll go outside and you'll look at your car and go, oh, there's my car. You know, it's exactly the same as it was before, and it's my car. I'm totally responsible for it. But you forget the people who mine the ore to make the metal for the car and tap the rubber trees to make the... Everything is made of parts and causing conditions in your perceiving mind. And, yeah, like Sandy said, you look at the same thing and you see... Two minds will look at one thing.
Everybody in this room could look at this, and some would think it's beautiful. Some would say, oh, it's blue. I like red. It's how you will perceive it. And then you'll put on it, I like it a lot, and you'll get the attachment, oh, I want that. Okay, I think I need it. And then there'll be other people that, oh, no, I don't. But it's the same thing, right? We're all looking at this thing. So there is something here. Okay, there is not nothingness. We don't go there. There is something here. But you're looking at this, and you're going to all of a sudden put all of these things on top of it, your likes, your dislikes, all the layers that go on it. Okay? So just you want a meditation cushion for your room at home. So, well, there's one. You know, I don't want my room. I want it to be bigger. I want it to be fluffier. I want it to be this. I'd rather it was blue. I'd rather it was this. I'd rather it was that. You bring your own agenda to things, so your own projection, okay, and that's based on your karma, okay, it's based on a lot of things that are coming before, but there is something here, but we're not seeing it in the right way, and that's the whole crux of this, is that that's what's causing our suffering. Okay, is because we're not seeing it the way it really is. That's really it in a nutshell, no pun intended. But when you can start working with that, okay. So, dependent arising, the way that things exist conventionally, it's dependent on all this, and we think everything's permanent. So that car of mine, I love that car. That car makes me really happy. And it's there, and it's always going to be there. Well, you know what? I went out this morning, and it didn't start. I didn't like that car so much today. Okay, but I expected it to be there. I expected it to always be there. I expected it to always work, and we get upset when it doesn't. I love my husband. I expect him to always be there. There was a time when he was going through some medical stuff. You know, we just think everybody's going to just be healthy and happy, and then we're upset when, humanity comes through and he got sick. So we don't expect these things. So it's these ups and downs of the impermanence of life and the impermanence of things. And we put our egos on this. Okay? So I am standing up here in front of all of you, and I'm trying to lead you through these discussions. And in my mind, I will have things like, boy, I hope they like me. I sit and I think about what I'm going to wear so I don't look too chubby. Okay, just all these kind of funny things, okay? But now that's my ego, okay? And I try to let go of that because none of this is about me. None of this should be even in my mind because I'm trying to portray it. So these are the things that go through my head sometimes. But it should be, so I try to let my ego out. That's a whole other practice. But it's just to focus in on these things and to be able to share this knowledge. But you all have the egos. We all have them. We think of this self-existent I. Okay? And then we get so upset when something happens to disturb that view that we have of ourselves, don't we? And everything we do is kind of based on that self-existent I that really doesn't exist. Okay? Yes.
When they discovered penicillin, or when we're learning more about neutrons and atoms and things that exist, but we don't know about them, we don't have an opinion about them, and we haven't formed a judgment, but yet they're existing.
They're existing? Okay, so that's the one hand clapping in the forest thing, right? You know, there's a lot of Zen masters that will walk you through a lot of those things. So you're not aware of these things, but it is in this world. Those things are in this world, and you actually are hearing about them. You just don't see them. Right. Yeah. So in some instances, again, now we can go around with this one because this is the one hand clapping in the forest discussion. If there isn't a labeling mind, if there isn't somebody there that's going to see it, then does it? Why? And this is completely my point of view. Why worry about it? That's just me. I've got a lot of stuff over here that I'll. But that's that one hand clapping in the forest. Chris, you probably got something to say about that one because you're pretty deep. He's much deeper than me. I'll just kind of go, well, yeah. And then move on over here. But that is what is supposed to be, causes and conditions, their parts, and that labeling mind, a conscious mind that is going to perceive that. Otherwise, if those conditions aren't there, then it's not there. Okay? But this is that part of that talk about emptiness of, we don't mean emptiness as we do talk about emptiness from a Western perspective, where if I took everything out of here, that box would be empty. We're talking about emptiness, meaning it is not the way that we're perceiving it. We're wrong in the way that we are perceiving it. That is the root ignorance and why we suffer. Because if we could see things as they really are, if we could see those relationships as they really are, if we could see these things as they really are, we wouldn't suffer as much, would we? You just wouldn't. Yes.
Would that mean
So is that a way of saying that in Buddhism is nothing empty? I don't know if that makes sense. Like what you just said.
It's nothing. That's a good one. Nobody there about that. There are no, you could say there are no partless parts. I don't think that there, nothing is empty. There's something there. We just don't, we, and I'm using us in this class, are just not seeing things the way that they really are. There are Buddhist masters. There are people that, you know, have been practicing for a long time, and they have meditated on the wisdom of emptiness, and there's different levels to it. I've not experienced that, but I've read about it, and I've read it from sources that I trust, which is part of that practice. Nothing. I'm gonna ask Gus for that one. That was good. It says nothing empty. Bob Thurman. That would have been a good one for him. Yeah, I just haven't heard. I haven't actually. Have you heard that one, Chris? So nothing.
Well, yeah. Do you mean empty as in there's always something in?
I mean it exactly as it sounds.
Yeah. So nothing is empty from a Buddhist perspective is where she's going with that. And I would have to say, so that's the first time I've heard it that way.
Everything is empty in the Buddhist sense. I mean, nothing really exists without parts and causing conditions and a perceiving mind. Everything is that way. Yeah.
Everything is empty.
Right.
What? I just said nothing.
Yeah, but she's saying nothing is empty. So everything is empty.
Empty she was
she
using,
needs to turn it around.
Yeah. I think that...
Okay, so go with your thought again. So try it again, because we got turned around there. Okay?
Okay.
Say your statement again.
So if we're talking about... So, I mean, is nothing truly empty? You know, or are there things there that just because we can't see them doesn't mean that they don't exist, that there is always...
There is always something there. There's always something there.
Exactly.
We are not seeing it in its true nature.
Okay, I just didn't know, like, if that was...
I went way too deep there.
Yeah. No, you didn't, Sandy.
No, you didn't.
One thing you didn't touch on, though, Sandy, or maybe you did, but the root delusion, you may have mentioned this, is that you are not empty. You think that there's an...
Yeah.
Right, but just think about it. Every piece of your flesh and bone and everything else that makes you up went through a worm sometime. That I read that someplace, and that meant a lot to me. Maybe,
he's talking about, yeah.
You know, everything is made up of parts.
He's talking really about the self-existent I. We sit here, okay, I can sit here and think, you know, I exist from my own side. We all think that we exist from outside because it's just the nature of how we have gone through things and the karma that we're living and just all of these things. But when you really start to work on this and you really start to break it down and you really start to work with it and you try to find that self-existent I in here. Sit with that one sometime and try to find it. What is that? Is it, you know, is it your... mind? Is it your brain? Is it your heart? You know, just try. What is that? And you start taking things apart. Where is that? So then people look at that and they'll go down this negativity, or they try to take it either too far to the nihilistic side, or they try to take it with that it's just depressing to them. And I have always looked at it as just this incredibly positive thing, because if I can work on that and I can work and find that true Buddha nature and see things as they really are and try to lose that self-existent I thought, then I'm just left with that purity, you know, because Sandy's got a lot of foibles. You know, I've got a lot of things I do wrong. I'm so not a perfect person, or I'd be a Buddha. So I want to work on that. I'd love to get rid of all these parts of Sandy that I don't like. And so for me, that is such a inspiration that I can through this practice, I can. Miss Bodhicitta, I mean, I got to work at it, but it's doable. And I have found with this practice for me personally that my life is better. I am a happier person. I do practice these things. I really try. I'm not perfect. You know, I still get angry. I still get these things. But now I can recognize it and I can work with it. And it just, it makes life so much easier and it's so much happier. I want to talk about next. Any more questions on this? We just really blew through this whole topic, but that's always what happens here. We have so little time. Okay? So we talked about all of these things, from karma to emptiness, from bodhicitta to, you know, the spiritual guide, to a couple of the prayers, to the history of Buddhism, you know, who is Shakyamuni, and there's so much more, okay? This was just, we just skipped right along the top of all of these things. So what would the next steps be if you wanted to find out a little bit more? You guys have the best karma, and you know why? The two-year class of Discovering Buddhism is starting another round on Monday with the first class. That is such an opportune time for you guys to, if you really want to find out a little bit more. And Robbie Watkins is the teacher of this one. It's Mind and Its Potential. I've talked about this before with some of you. That is one of my all-time favorite classes because it just lays the groundwork for so much. And Robbie, he teaches in a manner that really works for me because he just will fire stuff. I mean, it is just lists and this and this, and he will go through it. He's a long-term practitioner. In fact, he's the spiritual or the center director, and he's a phenomenal teacher. But that's going to be starting on Monday, and that is the Monday night, 7 o'clock, same thing, 7 to 8:30. That will go for 5 or 6 weeks, and it will just be on that subject. Okay, and then we'll go through each of those other subjects. The things that we had 15 minutes to talk about, they've got, you know, 10 hours. So check that one out. Next Tuesday, instead of Discovering our Buddhism in a Nutshell, it will be Meditation 101 with Jill Marie. She's a phenomenal teacher. She is a meditator. She's got that thing, you know, some people just have that, just that little calm thing. She does yoga. She teaches yoga as well. Phenomenal teacher with that. But she will take, you'll have an hour there, 7 to 8:30, and it's not an hour and a half of meditation. She'll do little ones and then talk about it, little ones and talk about it. She'll do a lot of the meditations that we've done, but she'll go into them in a lot more depth, and you'll have a lot more opportunity to discuss having your own meditation practice. We also have a very special event this Thursday. If anybody's interested in feng shui, we have a feng shui master coming. And so that's going to be a special event that will be happening Thursday night starting at 7 o'clock. Now, there is a suggested donation for that one. Most all of our classes that we have here at Kadampa Center are free of charge, and we're able to do that through the generosity of our members and our visitors. We're almost an entirely volunteer-run organization, and any donations that are made are just gratefully accepted so that we can continue to offer these courses and classes for free. But there is a suggested donation. I think it's $10 for that one. But he will be having workshops. So if anybody's interested in that, check it out, because I think that's going to be an interesting topic. I'm going to go into the first one, and then I'll decide if I want him to give me a come to the workshops, or you can have him come to your house too and give you. But that scares me. That would make me nervous. If I had a certain piece of furniture that I shouldn't have, I don't know about that, you know. I got 3 cats. There's nothing I can do about the cat tower, you know. It's got to be there. I really appreciate everybody's time. I really hope that if there's anything that you hear that confused you, please follow up. You know, let me know. There are some phenomenal teachers here. And I hope that I didn't say anything. If there's anything done or said wrong, that is my fault and not anybody else's. And if you've got any questions, check it out. There's some great people here, great classes here. We have a wonderful community. Right now we also have a visiting teacher. Venerable George Chernoff is here. He's also a very world-renowned teacher in the Galupa tradition. He and Robert Thurman went out for lunch. They go way, way back. I love seeing that hangout thing with these people that, you know, you tend to kind of, and they're just guys, and it was good. But he's here, and he's teaching. Now, he's teaching Wednesday nights and Friday nights. Wednesday nights we have our Lam Rim class, and Geshe-la has been teaching that class, and it's really going step by step through the graduated path, through the books, the commentaries. He's not teaching on Wednesday nights now? The Lam Rim meditations now. Okay, thank you. Yeah, I've been so busy in traveling, I haven't been able to do so many things. And I believe that George invited anybody to come to Friday nights. Okay. Check that out, okay, if you've got a chance to sit and have a little bit of discourse with Venerable George Chernoff. It, like I said, some of these teachers just get the impression, just go one time, just so that you can get that impression of being around some of these really phenomenal teachers. But I just thank you for spending your time with me. If you've got any questions, let me know. So, I can't believe it's over. Go so quick.